Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. So today we have a special episode. This is one that we've been planning for a long time. We have an active versus passive investor debate here. We have two experts, one for each side. We have Rick Ferry. How's it going, Rick?
Well, thank you.
Rick is backing the passive side. And we have our prior guest here. We have Tom Sosnoff. How are you doing today, Tom?
I'm great. Thanks.
Good. Well, Tom is backing the active side. So I'm excited for this because I know there's always a debate between both sides of active versus passive. And I'm excited because you have experts, some of the top investors that are known out there, and they back different sides. So I think this is a way to get down to the meat and potatoes, and let's get in it. So let's start with you, Rick. So let's talk about your approach. You back the passive investing side. What are some of the top reasons that the passive side is the best one for investors?
Well, it's the best one for most investors. I wouldn't say all investors. There are some very highly skilled institutional level investors, such as the endowment committee at Yale, who can actually go out and select active managers at a very low fee and potentially do better. In fact, they've shown they have done better. But for the rest of the masses, the other 99.9% of us, doing just a few good low-cost index funds is probably your best approach. I mean, you could get lucky and you could pick some stocks or pick some fund managers who actually do outperform, but mostly that's going to be through luck and not because of any skill. So in order to reduce the probability of at least not keeping up with the market, to increase the probability of just getting your fair share of return, which is what John Bogle would say, you just do a few low-cost index funds, and it's proven to be a superior strategy to 95% of everything else that's out there.
Okay, great. Well, appreciate that, Rick. Tom, what about you? What are some of the top reasons people should be considering active investing as opposed to passive?
So I take a completely different approach, obviously. I've been on the active trading side of the markets now for, this is my 40th year in the active space. And the simplest way I can explain it is, I don't think that anybody goes through any part of their life and says, you know what, I'm going to be passive about something. And the idea of passive investing to me is no different than being passive about anything else. And to me, it's a non-learning to an unlearning process. It's uninteresting. It doesn't change the net effect on returns. I mean, you're basically just hoping that, hey, I hope for a 10-year bull market, or I hope for a 12-year bull market, or whatever it is, or I hope for a 15-year bull market. But the takeaway is the learning process, everything that comes from that, I don't get it. Like, I don't really understand. Now, I can go back and say in the 70s or 80s, maybe even in the 90s, before there was technology and before there was low fees and before there was access to the markets and before there was really good content, I can get the message. I can understand why people were conflicted and they probably didn't want to manage their own money. But in the 2000s, 2010s, and 2020s now, there is no reason why anybody would want to have their money passively managed by somebody else, which is a person that's probably more conflicted than you as an individual. So I don't even actually get it. I don't understand why anybody would be passive as opposed to being active. It just doesn't register in my brain.
Yeah, that's a good point. So Rick, maybe you can respond to this, because to Tom's point, you know, we've had, I think about the markets this way, the markets either go up, down, or sideways. And the passive approach is basically relying on, you know, if you look at past few decades, you look at the 80s, 90s, and pretty much the 10s, you know, we've had a bull market and it requires that the markets go up for passive investors to do well. So, but then you look at the early 2000s and it pretty much went sideways for about 13 years. So what can you say to that approach when you're looking at a passive, when, you know, you're not accounting for the sideways or maybe even the downward markets?
Well, passive strategies, if you have an allocation to stocks and bonds, then you have the discipline to stick with that same allocation. I'll call it 60-40. That's a common one. 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And I'm not saying that's what you would have. I'm just using that as an example. And the markets go down, you would do rebalancing and you would take some money out of bonds and you would be buying stocks. The markets go up, stock market goes up. You'd be taking some money out of stocks and you'd be buying bonds. This actually added during the 2000s, that 13-year period that you were talking about, Kirk, that actually added about 1.5% to your return. So a sideways market is actually good for passive investors who are doing rebalancing as they should, and they pick up excess return just by buying low and selling high. Not that they're trying to pick the bottoms and the tops. They might just do this once a year, or they might use a percentage band or something to do this. But let's say you just do it once a year. The data shows that during that period of time, you would have picked up an extra 1.5% return. So passive, it has worked. The research that I did and others have done looked at various periods of time during bull markets, during bear markets, during sideways markets, and the passive approach outperformed the active approach in every single period. Didn't make any difference. The cost and the fees of active management drive down the returns below the returns of just buying the markets. And that's been true for as long as the data has been analyzed, and the data has been analyzed as far back as the 1920s, that this is in fact true. Now, you couldn't do passive investing until the mid-1990s. By that time, you had the ability to buy a U.S. index fund, an international index fund, a bond index fund. But prior to that, you didn't have that ability. So call it 25 years, you've had the ability to actually do this passive portfolio. And it has done very well. Again, you're not going to be the top 1%, but you're going to be in the top 10% of all investors if you do this.
And that's a good point. And Tom, I know there was a famous bet Warren Buffett made with a hedge fund manager that Buffett said he would take the index and the hedge fund manager could invest however he wanted actively. And, you know, Warren said over a 5 or 10 year period that he would come out ahead, and he ended up winning. So you look at a guy like Warren Buffett, who's obviously one of the best investors of our time, who's suggesting more of a passive approach. And I think his personal strategy is passive. You know, what do you say to that when investors are looking at that and saying, well, Warren Buffett can do it, why should I be active?
I don't really want to get into a Warren Buffett discussion, because over the last 20 years, I think Buffett's return has underperformed, you know, virtually every benchmark out there, and to a significant extent. So I don't really know if he's changed with the times. So I'm not sure how valuable that is. In fact, he missed the entire technology move, among other things. So I don't really know if that's even relevant. But I just want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples. When I talk about active, I don't talk about active management. So I mean, the difference is that I think Rick was referring to active management, which I would agree with him. If you're talking about passive versus active management by third parties, I completely agree with Rick. That's not my definition of active. My definition of active is not having somebody else actively manage your portfolio trying to outperform an underlying index. So if the index is up 10% and you're up 9 or 11%, that's what we call active. I have no interest in that. My definition of active is an individual, you, me, Rick, whoever it is, managing their own money. And in that case, I look at active management as an attempt to outperform risk-free rates. And when I say risk-free rates, I'm not talking about interest rates now, because risk-free rates are zero. We're talking about kind of passive rates of like index funds. So when I look at my objective, when I start the year, a brand new year, and I look and say, what, you know, the market's supposed to, or averages, let's say 5, 6, 7, 8%, whatever number it is after fees and everything else on a passive level, then I want my active returns to be at least 2, maybe 3, maybe 4 times higher than those passive returns. I'm not talking about giving it to a manager, telling them to, you know, sell a few calls against my portfolio, or just try to whatever kind of tax efficiency they want to throw on that portfolio. That's not it at all. I want individual investors, self-directed investors, to learn how to reduce basis, make decisions, use all the products available to them. And there's a serious problem with passive investing as we get further along. Basically, and again, I'll repeat, passive investing relies almost 100% on a bull market. And I feel like investing in the current era that we're in is much more about learning about finance. And it's being active in the world of finance. It's being engaged in product. It's being engaged in strategy. It's being engaged with your own money. It's never been done before. I mean, if you're a passive manager, if you have your money being passively managed, you're going to be waiting till 2030 before you buy your first digital asset. You're going to be waiting till, you know, you're going to basically be next to dead before you trade your first future. And we're talking about an era that should support capital efficiency. It should support strategy. It should support innovation. It should support all different kinds of access to all different marketplaces via all different strategies, via all different forms of technology. And you just don't get that with passive. So I'm sorry, like, there is no benefit to me. I do not see any benefit other than a marginally consistent, maybe some more consistency, less volatility of returns over a long period of time. But to me, that's not interesting. Life's too short. That's not interesting at all. And I do not buy into the theory, like the Jack Bogles of the world and the Warren Buffetts of the world are not my heroes when it comes to the world of finance. Not at all. Some cases, not so much Warren Buffett, but the Jack Bogles of the world have done more damage than good to engage people in the world of finance.
That's a good place to pick it up, because I think Bogle got his theories from Bert Malkiel back in his book in 1973. But, you know, Rick, what do you say to that? Tom's saying that it's kind of damaging for investors, the passive form of investing. What do you say to that?
Let me just clarify a couple of things that Tom said. Number one, 99% of my clients are self-managed. They manage their own portfolios. I don't manage money. I'm an advisor. I just charge an hourly fee to help them with their portfolio and so forth. So I'm not a money manager and I'm not a broker. I don't sell products. I don't get paid AUM fees. I just get paid an hourly dollar amount to help clients who are self-managing their own portfolios, but have had the epiphany of indexing, had the epiphany of passive investing, and have decided to go that direction. The problem with everything Tom said is you do not have, as an individual investor, the two things that are needed to outperform by, as you said, 2 to 4 times the market return, Tom. Number one, you need superior information, not the type you get off the internet, not in a chat room, not in a charting program of some sort that everybody has access to and that people are selling out their newsletter or whatever it is. You need superior information about a particular company, about the markets, about the economy that other people just don't have. And as an individual, you don't have that, period. You got the same stuff that everybody else gets. When it comes to companies, by law, companies cannot release information to you or anybody else until they give it to the rest of the public. So that's number one. You do not have superior information. But even if you did have superior information, even if you had it, you have to know how to trade on it. Because you can have superior information, but if you don't know how to trade on it, when to buy, when to sell, it doesn't do you any good. Just having the information and trading wrongly on it isn't going to do you any good. So you need the superior information and you need to know how to trade on it. You need to have the skill to do that. And individual investors, 99% do not have it. Not more than that, don't have it. Institutional investors don't have it, which is why, getting back to our previous discussion, most professional investors don't outperform the market either. Now, you can get lucky. You can get lucky. Okay. I mean, people get lucky all the time. They invest in things and they go up. Is this skill? No, it's very difficult to repeat it over and over again. You can't repeat it. So you know you've gotten lucky because the next time you try it doesn't work. And so you have to keep changing your strategy and changing your strategy. And the net result of all this is you end up underperforming just a passive index funds, which gets us to the epiphany of, why don't I just buy an index fund? Now, getting back to the question that you had, Kurt, about whether or not, you know, most people should do this or not. My view is that what Jack Bogle did was he democratized the capital markets. He allowed individuals to get their fair share of the return of the markets, and they weren't getting it. They weren't getting it. They weren't getting it through, as Tom said, through going through intermediaries like advisors and brokers, and they weren't getting it going through money managers and getting through mutual funds. They weren't getting their fair share of the market return. So what Jack Bogle did was say, look, we're going to democratize the capital markets. You can now get your fair share of what the market delivers. And that was a huge leap over what individual investors were getting prior to that. And I think that this is where Jack Bogle was a genius and should get credit for.
No, I think that's a great point. So, you know, Tom, one of the things that Rick said, and it comes up a lot in these conversations, is you look at active managers and they typically underperform the index. And there are definitely people who outperform, but consistently, it's hard to find people that are outperforming consistently. So how should people be looking at that with that argument? How can people look at active investing and say, this is a better approach?
Well, again, active managers, it does not surprise me one bit that they underperform because they're not very skilled and they're not very capable. I do not care about active managers. I care about individuals who are active in managing their own money. And I completely disagree with the premise that information is important. I actually believe I'm an efficient market theorist. I believe information is irrelevant. So I don't think that any individual in today's world is disadvantaged for one second if they read something on the internet or if they learn from a newsletter or on a course or whatever else it is. I don't believe that they're disadvantaged at all. I don't believe that professionals have any advantages because they have access to different forms of information. I actually think that if anything, that's a negative. I don't even believe if you knew what the numbers were going to be before the numbers came out, if they're a huge economic number, that you could effectively trade off that and have any idea what's going on. So I think that markets in today's world, more than any other time I've seen it, are so damn efficient because there's so much money chasing such small returns or the inefficiency of such small returns that I don't agree with any of that. And I believe in getting back to, you know, extending that argument, I believe the skill that most people lack and the reason that most people, and especially most active managers don't, is because they don't understand product, they don't understand capital efficiency, they don't understand implied volatility, they don't understand strategy, and they really don't understand the true definition of diversification and correlation, more specifically correlation. So when I look at the way people traditionally have said, oh, active underperforms passive, well, sure, active bad money managers that are active, of course, they're going to underperform passive money managers that are not active. But that's irrelevant to me because that's not even a function. Like the reason that I will pick on the Jack Bogles of the world, not because of the what people like to say is democratizing finance and, you know, bringing index funds and cutting fees and all that. I agree with all that. That's great. The problem with it is we now, for decades, we set back the active trader, the active investor for decades, thinking that the way to approach the markets was to let somebody else that knew more than them do it. And that was never the case. And so you can take the rawest newbie retail investor and you can teach them just like to buy and sell on a bid or offer, whatever it is, and they are not disadvantaged for one second, other than learning how to allocate their own capital efficiently and learning how to use different strategies and kind of the terminology of the business. But other than that, they are not disadvantaged for really for a second. Like if you said to me, hey, I've been watching every tick in the market for 40 years. I've literally watched every tick for 40 years. I'm an absolute junkie. I sit in front of the screen, you know, at least half of every day for the last 40 years of my life, including standing on the trading floor, including building two pieces of the most actively traded software ever, you know, ever used by customers. And I can tell you that between now and what's going to happen 15 minutes, an hour, or 15 days from now, I have no clue. And neither does anybody else. So there's nobody in the world that's watched the market more than I have, and I have no idea what's going to happen next. The idea that some, quote, institutional investor has an advantage over me because they have access to information is beyond ridiculous. So I am hugely in favor of empowering individual investors through technology, through low fees, through great content, and letting them do their own thing. Because there's another side to this, too, that we can't discount. When you make decisions with respect to your own money, and you own those decisions, the speed at which you make future decisions and the speed at which you process everything else in your life goes up exponentially, which makes you a better business person. And everybody that puts their money into passive index funds is disadvantaged in everything else they do in life because they don't have an opportunity to improve the processing speed of their brain with respect to making decisions. So that's another angle to active trading, which I think is understated.
No, I appreciate that last point, Tom. I don't think I've heard that anywhere else, but I appreciate that because I think that some of the things you said there about there not being enough active traders is actually part of a larger point I wanted to bring up. Which I want to address to you, Rick, is Michael Burry came out with a quote that said, passive investing is in a bubble. And there are a lot of institutional managers that have been talking about this for the last 5 years on how the passive investing, the amount of passive investing has grown significantly to the point where I think it's like, I don't know, 50% of investments are passive indexes. Active managers are even using passive ETFs. And it gets to this point of, you know, is this a bubble and are we creating a bigger problem because of, I would call it laziness, like some of the managers not wanting to do their work. So they just buy an index because it's easier. And a lot of them are indexing because that's part of the problem with active managers. They tend to index hug. So what would you say to people who kind of come out with the thesis that passive investing is a bubble and if people just keep investing in the index, then it creates some irregularities with price discovery?
You know, you hear a lot about this, and I did a conference call, well, not a conference call, excuse me, I did a podcast with Jerry O'Reilly, who is the manager of the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index Fund. And this is a $1.5 trillion mutual fund. It's the biggest mutual fund in the entire world. It literally is, I want to say, 3% of the stock market is in this one fund. He's also in charge of a lot of other trading as well. And I asked him this very question. I said, you know, from your point of view, and he's been doing it for 25 years, he's trading stocks for the index products of Vanguard. He basically said the miscalculation there is that we don't do a lot of trading. I mean, if you look at the volume of stock that's traded on all the exchanges in the United States, maybe on any given day, maybe 5% of the stock that's traded is actually going into or coming out of an index fund. That's it. That's all. 95% of the price discovery out there has nothing to do with indexing. So the idea that indexing is in a bubble, it doesn't compute in real sense. Now, maybe a lot of people are doing indexing and that's fine. And I think they should. And yes, some active managers are adding ETFs to their portfolio. I mean, active managers have always been closet indexers to begin with. So the index hugging that you're talking about has been very common. They charge higher fees to basically hug the index. As far as trading of stock and the volume of trading on the stock exchange that's index related is actually very, very small. And it doesn't have an effect. It doesn't affect prices. If you have a total stock market index fund that all buys all 3,700 or 3,800 stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, I mean, you're not affecting the price of any one particular stock. It's money coming into the market and money coming out of the market that might affect the whole market, but it doesn't affect individual securities. So the data, the actual facts don't bear out. There's a lot of speculation and there's a lot of buy active managers who are saying that, oh, indexing is bad and indexing is worse than Marxism and all that. You hear that from the active managers who are losing money. They're losing clients. They're losing out. Their business is eroding to passive management. It's eroding to indexing. And so they're trying to put out these narratives that really do not exist. It's really just not true.
Let's kind of talk about management of risk, because I think both approaches have a very different perspective on management of risk. So, Tom, when you're actively managing funds, how are you looking at risk management and how should investors look at risk management if they're more active as opposed to passive?
That's a great question. And I do want to add just one thing to your last question, which is on the passive side, you know, the overall passive side, the risk of the overall passive side is not so much the index funds in particular or any of that. The risk is that there's a massive amount of capital in the hands of very few people. And, you know, there's five firms that are controlling almost $20 trillion, $20 trillion in assets in AUM right now. And when you think about that, how concentrated the passive world is, Michael Burry is right. It is absolutely scary. And the idea that there may have to be at some time, some form of a liquidation event, I mean, it's almost uncontrollable. So yeah, that's what scares me. It's not the number, is just the pure concentration at the top. Anyway, getting on to the next question about how does individuals manage risk? Well, to me, you know, and this is why I brought up that piece about the concentration of all that capital, because as an individual, you cannot control that. When somebody goes to sell, there's no chance you're going to control it or get your whatever. It's going to be a nightmare. As an individual, you can actually control it by your size. So one of the things that we're very focused on, and we've learned this over many decades, is the only way to truly control risk is size at order entry. And there's no other way. Like, you know, everybody can talk about, I manage my risk, I do this and that. And whether you're passive, active, or actively managed, it doesn't make any difference. The only way to control risk is on the amount of capital that you have committed and when you opening up your trades. So that is the only time when you get to say, hey, you know what? This is a number. If something goes wrong, if it's some kind of an outlier move, if it's a 3, 4, or 5 standard deviation move, this is a number where I can handle the risk. And so when you control risk at order entry, which only you can do as an active manager, it's the only time you truly have control over your portfolio. And this has nothing to do with stop orders. This has nothing to do with protective puts. This has nothing to do with protective calls or anything else. We're just talking about the idea of reducing your standard deviation of risk and controlling your overall risk by position size. And you do that through non-correlation of strategies and underlyings. That's diversification of strategy, diversification of underlyings. And you do that by keeping your size small. You cannot do that as a passive investor. So I will argue that it is virtually impossible as a passive investor to manage risk, and active investors can manage risk. Now, fortunately for passive investors, for the last 12 years or 13 years now, they haven't had to manage any risk, except a little in 2020. But for the most part, that blindsided them anyway, so they couldn't manage risk. But when you think about it, passive investors do not have the capability of managing their own risk, and active investors are the only ones that can determine size and true portfolio diversification.
Yeah, those are great points, Tom. And I think it brings up this question for you, Rick, next is the same thing. Is I know with passive investing in the olden days, you know, diversification worked because assets were not highly correlated, but now assets are highly correlated if they're publicly traded for the most part, in large part because of the institutions, or at least that's what our research leads us to believe. So if that's going on, we're basically passive investing is protecting against volatility, but not true risk. You know, how do you look at risk management as a passive investor?
Well, Tom's version of risk management is more short-term oriented. As a passive indexer, my risk for my clients is not meeting their long-term financial objectives. That's their risk. And whether or not they get there. This is why when we come to the passive side, risk is very different. The risk on the passive side is what I call capitulation. That you come up with a strategy of how much you're going to have in equity, how much you're going to have in fixed income. You have the discipline to maintain that strategy because you're not over your head in risk. And if you are over your head in risk because you haven't figured out how much risk you can actually handle, and it is volatility, meaning short-term loss of money, and you capitulate on that long-term strategy, that's risk. So you shouldn't have had as much committed to the equity market as you did. So a lot of the work that I do with clients is try to help them figure out for themselves, how much is enough? How much should you have committed to the risk in the equity markets? And so that you will not capitulate when we have volatility in the markets, and that you'll actually do the rebalancing that's needed to be done to capture the excess return that you can get from rebalancing. Risk is very different for a long-term passive investor who's focused on life goals than it is for, you know, somebody who's trading. That's my view. I appreciate what Tom is saying. I agree with him and on many things that he said. But I think that with the education that I try to provide is not to be short-term, but how do you set up your portfolio for long-term? Because Tom's approach is good for people who do have a lot of time to be able to study this and to do this. But a lot of people don't have a lot of time. A lot of people are working on other jobs, and they have businesses to run, or they're physicians. They really can't be spending a lot of time doing this with their own portfolio, and they need to have a better long-term solution. And that's where this comes into play, this passive investment strategy. And so it is a different type of risk than I think that Tom is talking about. And you might be talking about, Kirk, as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So Tom, as we kind of talk about successes and failures in each approach, you know, what should investors look for as a mark of success for their approach in the active side? And then also as a corollary to that, how should investors look at it and know when their approach is wrong or when they're wrong in their approach?
Sure. And I just want to say that I agree with Rick with what he just said. I don't look at a portfolio as holistically as he does. And so we do have a different definition of risk. That's one of the hard things about comparing active to passive is that, you know, I can't look at anything on a very long-term, you know, multi-year basis, and he can. And that's a skill that he has that I don't have. So that's something different. But I think that I'm much more, and I believe people are much more focused on the here and now. Not, I just don't think we have the ability to look out necessarily 3, 5, 10 years, whatever it is. And I look at success as being able to exceed some. Success is measured based on the amount of risk that I'm taking. So I'll explain. So if the passive return on average for this year, let's just say in the S&Ps was, I assumed it would be about 7 or 8%, let's just say, then I look at success for me if I can do some multiple of that. That's how I judge success. Success to me is if the market's down 10% and I'm down 5%, that is not successful. If the market's down 10% and I'm not up 25 or 30%, then I'm mad at myself. If the market's up 12 or 20% and I break even or maybe make the same as the market's up, I'm pretty happy with myself. So like it really depends on, you know, like the kind of positions I know I'm going to hold. Like in other words, I view my world, because I'm a volatility seller, so I view my world as being able to take advantage of opportunities that the market gives me and compare that to whatever benchmark I set for myself at the beginning of the year. So I might have a year that I'm a little bearish, or I sold a lot of volatility, volatility expanded, and I broke even. I thought I traded great. I might have another year, the market's down 10% and I'm up 20%. I think I traded like crap. So it's a little bit different when you're active, because you trade, you're not benchmarking your stuff like somebody would in a more traditional sense. I haven't benchmarked anything in 40 years. I'm not going to start now.
All right. Fair point. Rick, what about you? What are kind of the markers of success for you? And how would you kind of look at it and know when your approach may be incorrect?
Again, we're goals-based, meaning that the goal of the strategy is to get you to a point where you can reach financial independence and at some point retire. So if your goal is 2 million, we basically put expectations of returns on long-term equity and expectations of return on long-term fixed income and cash, and come up with an allocation of what reasonable rate of return you would get from your asset allocation, and you know, how much money you can put in, how much money you currently have, and project out how long it will take to you to get to where you need to go, both on a nominal and an inflation adjusted basis, and implement the plan. And the goal is simply, how is it tracking? How close are you to getting there? If the markets do really well, like they've done, and you're closer to your goal, or you actually exceed your goal well before you thought you should, then it's a discussion about, is this now still the right asset allocation to maintain now that you're at your goal? And should we reduce the risk in the portfolio, or maybe not? Because maybe you have, it's always good to get these discussions. These are the discussions I have with clients, which again, far different than what Tom would have with his clients. The benchmark is your goal, and the capital markets are going to do what they're going to do. And if there's one prediction that I make, it is that the global economy will continue to grow. That's the prediction. And we all hope it does, because if it doesn't, I think we're all in trouble in the long term. So we hope that the global economy continues to grow, and therefore stocks will outperform bonds. There'll be a risk premium, and that stocks in the long term, intermediate term bonds anyway, will be less volatile than stocks, and cash will be less volatile than intermediate term bonds. There'll be big long-term capital market gorilla type views of things that we can manage this thing going forward, not over a 1 year or 6 month period, over decades to get you to where you need to be so that you reach your financial objectives and beyond if you want your children or your or somebody to inherit your wealth in the future. So this is the view that I take. It's a, you know, 10,000 foot or 100,000 mile view of things. But again, most people don't have the time to try to figure out how to, you know, get in and get out of markets quickly and do the things that Tom's talking about, volatility trade. They need something like this to, this is the highest probability for them to reach their financial goals, rather than going down the road of using active managers and advisors and paying all these fees. And as both Tom and I both agree, that's not the way to go.
So I want to touch on another area, which is a common area of concern for investors, which is fees. So Tom, your approach is more active, and fees traditionally, I know now everyone pays zero for trades, but traditionally fees kind of eat into the return with active. probability-wise, you're doing more trades than passive. So how do fees play in? How do you look at those with your approach?
Like you said, first of all, stock trading is free now. So there's not even, there are no fees. So you can't, but very few people use stocks because stocks are capital inefficient. For most individual investors, stocks have priced themselves, you know, out of the game. It's very hard for the average, you know, $50, $100,000 account now. It's very difficult to trade stocks just because stocks are too expensive. But there are no fees. So that they're not part of the equation anymore. So we only charge fees on option trades and on futures trades. And the fees are so minimal, they're less than the professionals pay for payment. So I consider them a non-factor now. I mean, they're down to a level where it's truly, they're non-existent. That said, it's almost impossible for me to envision an active trader that doesn't have a lot of fees because I like to trade. I'm a quantitative trader, which means I base everything off probabilistic outcomes. And I'm not talking about probabilistic, like a subjective probabilistic outcome. I'm talking about, you know, I'm an option trader. So every option has a delta. Every delta has a, you know, a real efficient probability. So I base everything off probabilities. When you do that, in order to achieve the outcome that you want, you have to play a game which of law of large numbers. So active trading does not work unless you are incredibly active. In other words, if you don't hit a certain number of trades, you are not going to achieve that probabilistic outcome that you've expected to achieve. I'm not talking about P&L wise. I'm talking about wins and losses wise. It's very different than P&L. So like if you're supposed to win 70% of the time, the only way you can win 70% of the time is if you do it enough times that you get to that as the normal outcome. Now, that doesn't mean you're up money. Even though you win 70% of the time, it doesn't mean you necessarily make money. But it means that you've achieved what your objective was. And for that reason, you need to be very active. You need to trade. You're going to have fees. To me, they are a non-factor in achieving that outcome and or that expected outcome. And that's what's so important about it. That's what's so neat about it, because there's no other place you can actually do that. There's no other marketplace that has no fees and efficient markets in the world, other than listed stocks, derivatives, and things like that. There's nothing else like it.
Rick, what about you? How do fees play into the approach that you have, and what should investors be looking at when it comes to fees?
I'd like to address fees, and then I want to talk about probably the biggest fee out there, which is taxes. Those two, if you don't mind, I'll address fees first. This is straight portfolio management fees that the mutual funds or the index funds charge, and trading costs if you're going to do exchange traded funds. They are, as Tom said, basically zero. I mean, index funds now you could buy at 0.03% for US total stock market index fund, but they're doing security lending within the fund that basically makes up almost that entire cost. And they're also doing a little futures arbitrage along the way, whether they're going to do cash or whether they're going to do securities. Or, in other words, they're able to, you know, sell the highest cost or buy the lowest cost, and they're able to make up a little bit there too. So, I mean, they're literally the cost of buying index funds, buying a total stock index fund is about zero. Total bond index fund is close to the same. Might be just a tiny bit cost of doing international and some of the other niche markets per se. There might be a little bit of a tiny cost, but let's call it less than 5 basis points per year, 0.05. That's what the typical investor that I work with, that's what they pay in mutual fund fees. Trading costs are literally zero because you're not doing much trading. Even if you're doing exchange traded funds, and the spreads on those are, these are very highly actively traded funds. So the spreads are a fraction of a penny when you're actually doing the trade. So it's very low cost, and you don't do much trading anyway. So fees are basically gotten down to just call it almost zero. Management fees are zero. The trading costs are about zero. You really are getting the returns of the markets now. And this has been a wonderful thing that's occurred over the last 20 years. As decimalization of trading has taken place, as different venues for trading has taken place, I mean, trading costs have come down to, you know, near nothing. And fees have come down to competition as everybody has entered this space. So there's all kinds of different total market index funds offered by everybody out there, all kinds of total bond markets index funds offered by everybody. And it's like a fee war, which is great for the investor. So that side of it is down to almost zero. The big cost to the people I work with is taxes. And this is where I work with them on developing strategies to manage their portfolios to reduce taxes. Where do you put things? If you have retirement accounts, do you put bonds in there? Do you put stocks in there? If you have Roth IRAs, you put stocks in there? If you have taxable accounts, should you use municipal bonds? Should you use taxable bonds? What kind of stock do you put in there? And then when you're doing distributions, when people are retired, they're doing Roth conversions and all this stuff. I mean, taxes in the big scope of things in people's lives with their investment portfolios is the biggest expense that they can run into. So advisors, I don't think advisors concentrate enough on taxes. The indexing stuff is solved. You create a simple indexing portfolio. It's solved already. It's been solved for many years. But the tax side of the equation has not been solved. And I don't think enough advisors are talking about it because it really costs investors a lot of money if they're not watching taxes. So those are my two points. Thank you.
As we kind of wrap it up here, I want to give you both a chance for final thoughts for your side. So Tom, let's start with you. What are your final thoughts on this active versus passive conversation?
I think it's pretty clear which side of the aisle I'm on.
You're on the soup aisle right now, just looking at your background.
Yeah. I've been building technology for retail investors to trade on their own now for 20 years. And prior to that, I spent 20 years as a market maker, you know, just basically making markets. So my whole career has been on the active trading side, and I've never done anything. But to this day, I mean, I still average myself personally, I still make between 75 and 100 trades a day. So I don't even know another world. I've acquired some reasonable wealth, and not one penny of my money is being managed outside of myself. It's not because I don't trust people or any of that kind of stuff, just because I like what I do. I feel like there's a lot more risk in the passive world now than people recognize. And it's not so much the risk of the market going down a little bit, or it's not so much the risk of, you know, missing out. What saddens me about passive investing is there's way too many conflicts, and it's always the first choice, where we try to make it the first choice for people, whether it's through their 401k, whether it's through something else. And I think that the line I like to use is, when we're 25 years old, we close our eyes one day and we take a nap and we wake up and we're 50. We wonder, where the hell did the last 25 years go? And how come I didn't learn anything about finance? That's why I was so excited to see kind of the whole meme stock explosion this year. Not because I could care less about Robinhood or the meme stocks themselves, but the level of engagement between meme stocks and cryptocurrencies to take an entire generation and finally engage them in finance when they're in their 20s, before they're in their 50s or 60s, to me, is fascinating. So I think that we're headed in the right direction for the first time in multiple decades. And I think earlier this year was a transformational moment in the movement from passive to active. And I think over the course of the next decade, you are going to see this accelerate, and the movement from passive to active is going to be unstoppable on every level. So I expect to see a lot of dollars and a lot of people and everything else flow into the active side, because people want to do their own thing.
That's great. No, I appreciate that, Tom, and I agree. I think it's great that people are more engaged with their portfolios. So thanks for coming on, Tom. So Rick, your final thoughts for you?
Well, again, I'm a long-term view here. I'm looking at getting people to their financial goals for retirement, and where should most of their money be? Most of their money should be in a passive strategy that has low fees, low taxes, and the highest probability of them to get to where they need to go. They don't have the time to learn about trading. And by the way, I'm 63 years old. So I went through the 1990s when I was in the brokerage industry, and I saw as Tom was saying, he hasn't seen this kind of level of active management with individuals in decades. Well, the decade that he was talking about is the 1990s, during the dot-com craze, when we went to discount brokers and everybody was quitting their job and getting an E-Trade account, you know, trading stocks that they had no idea where that company was located. They didn't care. They were just trading on momentum. That was fun. It was interesting. But it's not what those people are doing now. Those people are now calm down, and they've learned that, I need to be more long-term oriented with my money. I mean, this is fun. And I completely agree, by the way, Tom, with the idea that 20-year-olds should try to do some trading. I think it's very educational. I think the worst thing that happens is they actually make money, because they might think they actually know something. And that's really dangerous. They probably should try it and, you know, maybe lose some money and then finally say, I got to find something else. And that something else that they find in many ways is always going to be is this passive approach to long-term investing, where they'll meet they have a higher probability of meeting their financial goals. So that's where I sit.
Well, I appreciate you both coming on the show today. I know I learned a lot from this. I know the listeners are going to learn a lot as well. So thank you both for sharing your wisdom. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager of Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on the podcast app if you're choosing. Also, check out the show on moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to resources, show notes, and archive shows. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.